90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
The only good Indian is a dead Indian.
Welcome to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, and you're listening to Native Spirit Radio here. We are in the middle of our pledge drive, so of course we're going to remind you of what we provide for you here at this station. We're very thankful for our listeners, first of all. Thank you for tuning in and listening to us. But we do know that it costs money to run this radio station, so if you love this station and you want to continue hearing what we have to offer, great viewpoints, great diverse perspectives, as well as what we had Friday night at the Amplifying Community Voices event. It was really fun. I got to meet a lot of you guys out there and hear your suggestions on what you want to hear. But if you want to continue to make this radio station to thrive, we do need your help in that, and any help is important. Any part, any amount you can donate, you can give us a call at 888-931-0901. Again, that's 888-931-0901. And give to KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station. Again, giving you a different perspective on all the issues going on, as well as international and Native American. We'll be having Jacqueline Keeler calling in to give us an update on what's going on in North Dakota at the camps up there as well in just a few minutes. So again, if you want to donate to us, please do so. Again, that's 888-931-0901, or you can go online at kkfi.org and donate there as well. So we really, really appreciate that. All right, we'll get into the music and stay tuned. Like I said, Jacqueline Keeler will be calling us to give us an update on what's going on at the camps in North Dakota.
I don't want no Hawaii, no what? Why do parents gotta bury their kids? Why we text and drive, not caring how scary it is? Why it's so hard to forgive and leave the past behind? And if you did, then that's divine. Why don't you help your brother when you see him fall? Why do we act like God don't see it all? Why do we call them black, them white, them Asians and use labels? Now that's racism.
I don't wanna hold it. I don't wanna hold it. Yo, why? I don't wanna hold it. I don't wanna hold it. Yo, why? I don't wanna hold it. I don't wanna hold it. Yo, why? I don't wanna hold it. I don't wanna hold it. Yo,
why? Why is there innocent people locked up for life while some people can't say nothing nice? Why do we always gotta question what all of it means, and why won't you follow your dreams? Tell me why. The night when you took my dad, why'd you let me see my grandpa cry? And tell me why. And why did you choose to hide, even though you was born to fly? And tell me why. And why don't we turn from all the hate? And why don't we learn from all mistakes? Why do I keep on wrecking these fat beats? And teachers don't make more than professional athletes. And why?
Indians, Indians. Let me tell you about Indians. There's Hollywood Indians, they're fried bread eating Indians, there's wannabe Indians, they're fat, skinny, tall, blonde Indians. Let me tell you about Indians. Some are stoic Indians, Indians that ride hogs, Indians that ride Indians. Some are long-haired, beautiful Indians. Some are radical, free Leonard Peltier Indians. Some of them just don't give a damn Indians. Frankly, I like the type of Indians that always agree to be last on display Indians. Indians, Indians, Indians. Types that like to party and get drunk Indians. Types that like to fight other Indians. Types that like to fight, fight, fight. Go to a powwow, see them in their beautiful regalia, wicked smile, glint in their eyes, Indians. She was from Iowa, looking for an Indian. It didn't matter what kind, just one taller than her. Hey, you wanna see my horses? The church walls, painted with cheap stucco. Inside were promises. Hundreds of unsure Indians still waiting for something, not too sure of what. And when you're not too sure, very few treasures turn gold. We spent time that summer. You fell in love. Why? I needed a ride to Santa Fe, so I showed you my horses. I showed you my horses. Well, the four winds carried us east and west, north.
north to south, south to north, west to east. We ran into the winds, secrets were sculpted, sculpted by two naked, sweaty bodies in the desert moonlight. I broke your heart.
I broke your heart?
You said I broke your heart. It's not the first time this Indian has done it. I need a ride to Copper Mountain, Colorado, so you oblige. And when you're not too sure, very few Indians I know have ever turned to gold. Another one just like you to give me a ride to Tulsa, and I will oblige. Besides, very few treasures turn to gold, but all intentions have their own karmic goals.
All right, you're listening to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And that was Robert Mirabal with Indians and Indians. We started off with some Superman and Why. And sorry about that. I was playing a song and it just stopped. So that's why I just started with the Superman. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Right now, we're going to be speaking with Jacqueline Keeler. Are you there, Jacqueline?
Yes, I am.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being on. Ms. Jacqueline Keeler has been doing her own reporting on what's going on in North Dakota at camps up there at the Ocheti Shakowi camp. And you know, why don't you talk about what you've been doing with your own website, first of all?
Oh, my own website. Which website?
The the one you had started, a new one. What? Let me give you an introduction. Ms. Jacqueline Keeler used to write for Indian Country Today, and then she kind of started her own stuff, doing her own blogging post where she could post some other stories of her own. And so, and I kind of think that's what you're doing with this. And that with, and then you're eradicating offensive Native mascots stuff you're working on.
Yeah. Well, I've had the blog Teoshpaya now for a while, and I've been working with a group of other Native writers and journalists developing a new sort of news outlet called Pollen Nation Magazine, and it's sort of a Native New Yorker. And then I also do a lot of writing. I'm a columnist for Telesur English. And so it's sort of a regular outlet there. And Telesur is sort of the CNN of Central America, and they're branching out to the United States, to the North American market.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so I've been a columnist with them for about a year, actually, now. I started covering the whole Bundy Malheur Wildlife Refuge takeover here in Oregon about a year ago on Telesur. And also I've been covering, of course, Standing Rock. And then I also write for other outlets, too, like... I've still been writing for The Nation and for Quartz QZ, which is a publication of The Atlantic Monthly, and also I'm writing now for Yes Magazine, and I just get you know asked a lot of places, more than I can actually fulfill on my writing obligations.
Definitely, because there's not many of us around, so it's like it's kind of funny because like. I'll have other journalists ask me for a quote. I'm like, well, I'm trying to write a story too, so I can't really quote on the when.
Yeah, you know. You get spread pretty thin, and it is. I mean, I wish I could write more. If I could produce more, I would definitely would. I spend a lot of time thinking about things because I feel like I need to have a good perspective. And since for Native people, our issues are not heavily discussed in the mainstream media, we often have to really have these discussions amongst ourselves to formulate our positions and understand our culture and how that relates to it. And so that's why we started a Pollination magazine, because we really want to pollinate the ideas. We want to create, it's an intellectual, we need an intellectual basis for how we fight, back. And so that's what Pollination is. And then it has the whole connotation. I'm half Navajo, and my clan is Kia'ani, and I'm born for the Ahanktuan, the Yankton Sioux people. And so pollen is very sacred in the Navajo traditions, and we pray with pollen and corn pollen and also white cornmeal. And so it has a notion that it's something that is very central to who we are as people. And so when I started Tiosh Baya Now, the blog, back in, I think, 2006, so I was really inspired by the work of my great-aunt, my great-great-aunt Ella Deloria, who was actually born on Standing Rock in Wakpala. And my grandmother's family lived for 40 years on Standing Rock. They're Yanktons, but they lived there and worked and served the community there. And so it's been really great to go back to Standing Rock and to reconnect. We were adopted by Chief Gall's family, their people, and to go back and reconnect with those connections that my grandmother's family had made there.
Definitely. Well, so last week we were talking about how we had heard of that the Cannonball District had asked for the campers to leave, and had others asking for them to leave if they were not from Standing Rock. And so it was kind of confusing of the message that was coming out. And I think, like, there's people here in Kansas City that are still, you know, trying to understand what's happening, some who still want to go up there. And it's like, well, I don't know what's happening, you know. So we're trying to give perspective over what's going on and what information needs to come out.
Well, I've been working on a piece, an article, about what it means to stand with Standing Rock. You know, I think there are different interpretations about what that means. And for me, it means standing with, I take it pretty literally. I mean, it means standing with the people of Standing, the tribe, the communities. And in my background, one of the first jobs I got at college was as a community organizer. And I worked in the Southwest. I first spent a year doing community organizing work with the Rio Grande Pueblos, from Jemez and San Felipe Pueblo all the way up to San Domingo. And then I spent a year working with the Zuni Acoma and the Eastern Navajo communities, and also First Mesa and Hopi. And when I was trained in this, we were taught to basically go in and ask the people what they want. And I was trained by this amazing Navajo woman, Abby Town Butler, and she just told me, she said, you may be Native, but you don't know what the people in this community want. You have to go and ask them first. And then what they may come up with, you know, their top three items may not be what you would even imagine would be, you know, an issue, but it matters to them, and it's your job to do what they want, you know, to make what they want happen. And so then we would organize, we would spend a year or so working on these projects, and then they would have ideas, things to do that wouldn't ever occur to me because I wasn't from that community. I may be even Navajo, it's a Navajo community, but they have specific ideas, and they know their community and what will work for them, and they have strategies. And so I was always trained as a community organizer to do what the people wanted to do, to first check with them and then to proceed. And I think that this is very traditional, and that it's based in our traditional community's ideas of consensus. We come to a consensus first. And the other traditional concept is of respected elders, which is extremely central to Lakota Dakota culture, which is completely based on kinship relationships, which are very firmly obeyed. I mean, I really can't imagine pursuing something in direct sort of opposition of what the elders have already wanted to. And so I think that, you know, at the Ochati Shakoan camp there, the main camp that is in the floodplain there, that camp was, there was an elders council put together by Chairman Dave Archambeau II. And he's the, you know, chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe had actually signed, sort of a lease agreement with the Army Corps of Engineers and is liable in many ways for what happened there. They've agreed to make sure it's cleaned out. It was a very specific agreement. And so he put together, you know, Chairman Archambault had a vision, and part of that vision that came to him was the reemergence of the reconstitution of the Great Sioux Nation, of the seven council players, of the Ocheti Shakowin. And this is why he put together this Elders Council to advise him. And this Elders Council is composed of elders from all seven council players. And the decisions made by this Elders Council are made in ceremony. So when they say to close down their camp and to come back together in the spring, this is something that was told to them in ceremony by the spirits. And so when they tell the other the young people this, in our traditional way, it's no question that they would be obeyed. But then you have people who are coming from a very different perspective, which is a very American perspective of individualism, that they can trust their own instincts, that they don't have to listen to elders, that they can just do what they believe is right because they're acting, you know, for some larger issue beyond the tribe, beyond the community. And I think that is what is sort of at odds here. And then, you know, I spoke to members of the cannonball community, and they had some really serious meetings, even in October, about this issue. And you know, in the first week of November, the tribal council, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Council, had made a unanimous vote asking Red Warrior Camp to leave. That was like November 8th or so. Maybe November 3rd. But in October, the cannonball community was really, speaking to some of the community members, they said that they felt they were worried about their children going to schools outside the reservation. It was traumatizing for them to see the level of hatred. They knew the hatred is there around them in the white communities all the time, but it's been sort of below the surface and not visible. And now it's visible. Now the hatred is, you can see it clearly. And this is traumatizing to them. And I would say that it's even more traumatizing to them because they were never consulted about the different strategies being utilized in their name. And after a lot of these activists leave, the community is going to be left with having to deal with the fallout for decades to come. And so I think it really is incumbent on organizers, even Native organizers, to really, really collaborate fully with the community to reach consensus on strategies being utilized. They may come to the exact same decisions, the exact same strategies may very well be used. But the issue is that they had a say. And really, that's the issue about DAPL, is the tribe wants to be consulted and have a say. And it's the same thing with their allies. They want to be consulted and have a say. And so I think that, you know, with a lot of our young people, even our progressive young people, they don't know the socio-cultural traditions, which are based in kinship and respect of elders. And so they are more guided by the principles of just general American activism. And so I think that is the big conflict here.
All right. We're talking with Jacqueline Peeler, and she was up at the camps in North Dakota working with the Ocheti Shakowi camp and talking about what's going on right now, because we've heard that the tribal council wants those that are not from Standing Rock to leave. And then there's been voices coming saying, no, we want people to come. So people are confused about what's going on, and Jacqueline's trying to give us an idea of what's been happening. So is Standing Rock still doing a GoFundMe for their camp?
If you go to their website, standingrock.org,
yeah.
They'll have a fundraiser up there. I think a lot of the different sites stopped asking for things because they just had such an overwhelming response. There's been so much generosity. I mean, there were warehouses in Bismarck and on the reservation, mm-hmm. filled with things that people were really backlogged going through. And with all the bad weather, it was very difficult to transport those things to the camp. And with so few people at the camp, it's not really necessary at this time. When the camp comes back together in the spring, I would say that's an issue. I think that a lot of people my family owns farmland on the floodplain, And I think people don't really understand how dangerous it is to live on a floodplain. When you're talking about ice dams, it's even really, really much more dangerous. Because 1 year we had an ice dam come through our farm, and and we had 50 head of Black Angus cattle, and it, in one night, in an hour and a half, it came through a mile. The ice and snow went a mile inland, and just killed all the cattle. The cattle were dead in the snow, just little black bodies in the snow, and we had our well was lined with a steel colander, which was an inch and a half thick, and it twisted it like an aluminum can. Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine if there were people there, mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty dangerous, I think that a lot of people coming from the city or like an urban lifestyle don't understand what it means to live on the land. They don't understand the real dangers involved. And I think that's where they become very stubborn, I think that would never have been a winter campsite for our people in the traditional, for a traditional Lakota community would never have chosen that place as a winter camp. It's just not appropriate. But I think the tribe, is worried about, of course, as a leader of a, as an actual elected leader of a tribe, they are held accountable for these things to an extent that, sort of individuals, even members of their own tribe, citizens, are not. So there is a different level of accountability. And I think also, the camp has been, quite expensive for the community to maintain. I mean, Standing Rock is not a wealthy reservation. Their main, they have to serve their own people. Maintaining that camp was, I think, $2,000 a day. And then it went up from there when the camp grew to 10,000 people. That's $60,000 a month. And then there was the issues of the blockade, the road blockade, which has really impacted the tribe's casino revenue, which they really depend on to fund a lot of their, their programs for their communities, and the main money made off the casino is not made off of hotels or even the dining areas. It's made off of the gaming revenues, and if people cannot get there easily, it makes it very difficult for them. The roadblock is definitely an atrocious, vindictive act by the state of North Dakota. It is in a de facto economic embargo of the tribe, but I don't know how much longer the tribe can afford to do that. And so they're working now with the president, governor, to basically lift the blockade so that they can restore some of their economy and also access to emergency vehicles, which is now blocked, and just their daily lives. I think we. When we go to help the people or stand with them, I do understand people have different definitions of what that means, but sometimes we have to listen to them and respect their opinion and their needs, their very real needs as a community.
Yeah, definitely. And I know that that road was the only direct road from Bismarck into where the casinos at on that main road. So now if anybody wants to go to the casino, they have to go out of their way to go to it. And I don't even know how many miles out of their way they have to go through it.
I heard 40 minutes.
Yeah, and it's definite. And who wants to spend another 40, it's probably over an hour to get there to just go to a casino when you can go somewhere else? I mean, it's definitely impacting them.
I did see that the tribe was offering $10 bus rides from Mandan mm-hmm. to the casino.
Yeah.
But I mean, still, it's not an impulse thing anymore. It's something you probably have to really. And when I was there, the number of people in the gaming area had really gone down from October to December. It just really declined.
If you want to just explain really small, I guess, just a short explanation of what the difference was between the Red Warrior camp and the Ocheti Shikoni camps.
Yeah, so the first camp, the original camp, was LaDonna Allard's camp, the Sacred Stone camp. She put that camp was established on April 1st, and that was the original camp. As that camp became, it's high on a bluff, and it's just in this little narrow area. It doesn't have a lot of room to grow. So the tribe then decided to do an overflow camp, which is actually across, hers is on the south side of the Cannonball River on the reservation, and then decided to do the overflow camp in the, on the north side of the Cannonball River, which is not on the reservation, but it is within the boundaries of the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, the unceded treaty lands that the tribe still has a right to. And so the overflow camp was then established in this floodplain. And the tribe actually had to negotiate with the Army Corps of Engineers for a permit to allow the camping. And part of the agreement was that they would take out insurance on the site. They would guarantee the safety of everyone who lived, who was there. They would also make sure that the site was completely restored to the state it was beforehand. And so, so this overflow camp is where all the, when you see the photographs of the several thousand Native people all camped out, that's the camp where they're camped at. I don't think that sacred stone ever got larger than a couple hundred people. And so when it was 10,000 people, they were mostly camped at the Otretisha-Colwyn camp. There was also a camp on the south side of the Cannonball River that was actually land leased from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe by the Rosebud Sioux tribe. They have their own camp there, the Rosebud camp, which was not on the bluff like Sacred Stone was, but was right on the Cannonball River. So you could easily cross back and forth between the Rosebud camp to the main camp. To get to the Sacred Stone camp, you have to drive all the way back into the reservation through Cannonball, down the Missouri. It's quite a way. Yeah. They're not really adjacent. They're not really contiguous. And so this main camp was composed of many, many smaller camps, representative of tribes, of groups like the Red Warrior Camp, and of other groups like the Rainbow Camp, tribes like the Cheyenne River, the Yankton Sioux had their camp there, many different groups, many tribes, many different organizations had their own camps there. So that was, so the Red Warrior Camp was one camp within a much larger camp.
Okay. Well, and then, you wanted to let people know that, that fight is not over. They're still waiting on the environmental impact statement, but people can go and look at the environmental impact statement and leave their comments. So they can go to the Federal Register and look it up to, and I will add that link to this podcast so people can get a link to, if they want to check that out and leave a comment on it, that, their fight is not over yet. They're still fighting. Do you know how many people are still at the Red Warrior Camp?
Well, I don't know. Well, I think a lot of them, but when I was there, they were closing up their camp. They left in December. So, so they were, I think that they are still sort of, camping with Sacred Stone, kind of in alliance there. The main, there is this camp that was within, in late October, when the elders were in ceremony, they were told, and these elders include Chief Orville Looking Horse, the keeper of the sacred pipe, and they were told to raise the horn, and the horn was really the spiritual center of the camp. And the horn comprised all teepees representing all seven council fires. It's in the shape of a horn. This was something that was done in our traditional camps in a time of stress. The buffalo horn would be shaped as a buffalo horn, and the tip would be pointed at the enemy. And so this is what they did. They raised the horn in late October, and the sacred fire was also relit there. And when the main sacred fire was put out, the sacred fire was still burning at the horn at that time. And there were camp leaders from each council fire that were there, and headsmen there to represent the seven council fires. I think that often what gets lost in some of the narrative about what's going on is the reemergence of the Great Sioux Nation. This is what is really at the heart of it to our people. Where the Dakota Access Pipeline is being constructed, some Dakota Lakota people say that is right near there, is where, not far from that site, near the camp, is where the white buffalo cattlemen appear to our people. And when she came, she brought us the pipe, Changpa, and she also brought us the seven sacred ceremonies, including, you know, the sweat lodge, you know, the you know, crying for a vision, you know, and the sun dance. And my Lala, you know, who was actually raised, born in Wakpala on Standing Rock, he used to tell me that that before she came to us, we were not Dakota or Lakota. After she came to us, that is when we became Dakota and Lakota. And so this is really, this pipeline corridor is actually really sort of a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's where the, it's where they, where our people became who they were, you know. We became Dakota, we became Lakota. And so I think it's, you know, there's a lot of amazing archaeological sites there. And the EIS is really important to be able to investigate these. I do encourage everyone to file a comment. And of course, the other actions going on are, of course, the divest actions, the divestment actions, which are having a lot of success. And yet, I really do encourage allies to support the sovereignty of our people, because you know, one of the reasons why so many environmental organizations turn to tribes to help them win environmental fights, like the fight against Apple, like many of the fights we see here in the Pacific Northwest against, you know, all kinds of other pipelines, and is because tribes have a standing as sovereign nations that gives them a stronger legal stance, legal rights than U.S. citizens possess. And I think that in exchange for our support, that we really need our fellow Americans to fully recognize tribal sovereignty of our the sovereignty of our nations. And the treaties, like the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, represent our you know, treaties are only signed between sovereign nations. They're not signed between any other groups. You know, the U.S. Senate does not ratify treaties with anyone else but other sovereign nations. Ratifying these treaties acknowledges the sovereignty of the Great Sioux Nation, of the Ocheti Shakoni. But it obviously our sovereignty and our pre-exists the signing of the treaties and persists. And that's the issue, is that this is the reconstitution of the political reality of the Great Sioux Nation, not just of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, but of all of the Great Sioux Nation. That's why Chairman Archambault has focused so much on making sure that representatives from every council fire, and the council fires go all the way to the Great Lakes. We're talking about the Dakota have four council fires, the Lakota have one, the Nakota have two. So the Yanktons, the Yanktawans are one of the Nakota, the other ones are the Yanktawana, who live on Standing Rock. And then, of course, the seven sub-council fires of the Lakota, you know, the Tetuan, the Papa, all those different groups. And so so this is, he's made sure to incorporate voices from all of these seven council fires. And so this is really, I think, what is at stake and what is key to what's going on and where the power is. The reason why, you know, you see the incredible military response going on in North Dakota is because of the assertion of sovereignty. You know, because they are asserting rights to treaty lands, unceded treaty lands which under international law belong to us, but which are held by military force by the U.S. government. And you see that military force going on today. It's, they're still held by military force, not by legal means. You know, signing a treaty does not sign away in fact, it's against international law to actually use a treaty to extinguish the sovereignty of a nation. It doesn't work that way. It's an act of sovereignty. So I think that getting Americans to really understand this aspect of it is crucial for long-term social justice around this issue. And yeah, we would like the return of the lands that we negotiated for under treaty, you know, which includes most of western North Dakota and South Dakota, including the Black Hills. So that would be justice. Of course, very intrinsically, the existence of states is in opposition to the recognition of our sovereignty of our homeland, because the U.S. and I would say is still a colony. It's a colony without a homeland, without portfolio. You know, it basically exists on other people's homelands and other nations' homelands. And I think that this is really what is, I think that a lot of Americans really need to get their minds around that concept. and really begin to recognize and fully support the sovereignty of our nation.
Definitely. Well, thank you for joining us, Jacqueline Keeler. We're updating us on what's going on in the camps in North Dakota, and you know, wish you success on your endeavors that you're working on.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right. Well, so yes, we were having an update on the North Dakota camps and what's been happening up there. So hope you guys enjoyed that. I do have to let you guys know we are in our pledge drive right now. And so if you enjoy hearing updates on what's going on in North Dakota from the camps and people who've been there, who are part of that movement, that's stuff you're not going to hear on any other regular radio station here in Kansas City, especially people who've been up there. I've been up there myself getting interviews with people, airing them here on the station. I don't know if anyone from Kansas City that, you know, went up there and did reporting, bringing it back here to you guys. But yes, if you want to get that diverse perspective of what's happening in different areas of the country, you tune in to KKFI. And I want this radio station to stay on the air. I believe in the mission of KKFI. I believe it's different than anything else that's out there. And I want KKFI to keep bringing that stuff that can't be heard anywhere else. And that's what I want. If that's what you want, call now and make your pledge to support KKFI. The number is 888-931-0901. Again, that's 888-931-0901. Or you can go online at kkfi.org to do your online donation as well. All right. Well, let me just do a quick rundown of what's going on across Indian country information. So one other interesting note, what's been happening in North Dakota. So they have two state representatives that want to push through some a bill that is reading a concurrent resolution urging Congress to modify the Indian reservation system by vesting the states with the ability to engage in relations with Native American tribes and with the responsibility of developing plans to improve the failed Indian reservation system. The bill is known as House Concurrent Resolution 3017, was introduced in North Dakota State Legislature this past Thursday. The bill was referred to the North Dakota House of Representatives Government and Veteran Affairs Committee. And a lot of Native people are seeing this as a prelude to termination and a threat to tribal sovereignty. If approved, states would have control of American tribes and their tribal lands. So it's going to be interesting to see where this goes, if anything is done with this. I don't know what's going to happen, but it'll be interesting to see. All right. So we've heard about President Trump dealing with the construction of the wall. And one interesting part of this is that part of this wall would go through a reservation in southern Arizona that includes 75 miles of the U.S. border with Mexico. Tribal citizens live on both sides of the border and travel back and forth for ceremonies to visit relatives and other regular activities. But as a first responder on the international border, the tribe does not support a large-scale fortified wall through its lands. The statement on Thursday read, the tribe is instead inviting Trump to come to the region to learn more about the impacts of his controversial directive. The executive order signed yesterday was done without consultation with the nation or many other border communities, the tribe said. Trump's order did not say how much a border wall would cost or who would pay for it, but his spokesperson said during a press briefing at the White House Thursday, he said one idea was to impose some sort of import tax on goods coming from Mexico. So this is the Tohono O'odham Nation in Arizona saying that they are not going to do this wall with them. So it's interesting to see what's been happening. Also, just an update and update or information for you guys. There's a new television series produced in partnership with Vice Canada and APTN, Aboriginal People's Television Network, and it just debuted this past Friday. It was called Rise, and it's on Viceland. The first two episodes were about the Dakota Access Pipeline. They traveled to North Dakota to visit the home of the Standing Rock Sioux and talk to people about what was going on. The next episodes are going to be about Oak Flat, a sacred Apache site in Arizona, which we talked about this on this station. And so they're going to be going down to Arizona to look at that as well. A quote was, Rice is groundbreaking through his voicing of important issues around land, decolonization, and political governance told through an indigenous point of view by showcasing the people who are leading this change globally. Producer Michelle Latimer, who is Matisse and Algonquin, said in a press release. And I think Viceland's great. They've already been doing some really awesome networking with not just with this show, Rise, but different shows as well, talking about Native issues more so than I've seen in any other cable networks working on stuff. So if you tune in, make sure you record or watch Rise on Viceland. Again, we're in the middle of our pledge drive, and you can give us a call and help support KKFI. That is at 888-931-0901. And so they're doing this special, you must call in to do these, but a $100 donation or more, you get a single pass to the KC Folk Fest Sunday, February 19th. But you must call in. That is not available through online donations. And so, again, that is on the air. You must call in to do that $100 donation to Kansas City Folk Fest. Also, there is the shirt and a guest DJ spot, which is for $240 or more. If you want to do the shirt and KC Folk Fest single pass, that's $190 or more. And the guest DJ and KC Folk Fest single pass, $250 or more. So again, give us a call at 888-931-0901 for more information if you want to donate to KKFI for our winter 2017 fun drive. And again, it keeps great music and great issues talking about this stuff on the air that you don't really hear on any other radio station here in the Kansas City area. So if you guys are enjoying that, thank you for listening to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And we'll get back into the music. Hope you guys enjoy this.
I got a pretty girl.
I got a pretty girl.
I got a pretty girl.
Way down in Kennedyville.
Way down in Kennedyville.
Way down in Kennedyville.
Way down in Kennedyville.
Way, way, Jonah.
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 The second annual Kansas City Folk Festival is back Sunday, February 19th, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Westin Crown Center Hotel. This one-day, all-ages indoor event is for music lovers, families, and art appreciators looking for a summer festival vibe in the dead of winter. Supporting KKFI, Kansas City Folk Festival features an artisan market, children's programming, an Irish dance, a morning sing-along, as well as local, national, and international artists on multiple stages, including a kids' stage featuring Grammy Award-winning children's duo, the Okie Dokie Brothers, along with Kathy Fink, Marcy Markser, and KC's own Brandon Draper's Drum Safari. Tickets and information about the February 19th Kansas City Folk Festival, kcfolkfest.org.
All right, you're listening to Native Spirit Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Rhonda, and it's about my time to be getting out of here. Sunset Reggae is coming up for you next. Remember, if you want to support KKFI, make your donation. You can give us a call at 888-931-0901. Again, that's 888-931-0901. Or you can go on online at kkfi.org. Everybody have a wonderful week, and we'll see you again next Sunday.
I love you. City Community Radio. We're in the midst of a fun drive, and a lot of the people answering the phones are